I'm Silas Farley, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Hear the Dance. In this episode, we will focus on one of the most important choreographers of our time, Pam Tanowitz. Pam is the founder and artistic director of Pam Tanowitz Dance, and she is one of the most sought-after choreographers in the world. She has made work for the Martha Graham Dance Company, the Australian Ballet, the Vale International Dance Festival, London's Royal Ballet, American Ballet Theatre, ABT, the Nantucket Dance Festival, New York City Ballet, and more. Her works have drawn on a wide range of sources and inspiration, from her vast knowledge of dance history to T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, to the Goldberg Variations by Johann Sebastian Bach, to the biblical Song of Songs, and from her studies at Ohio State University and at Sarah Lawrence College, where she worked closely with Viola Farber, who had been a founding member of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. We will center our exploration of Pam's work around a ballet entitled The Law of Mosaics, which she made for New York City Ballet in 2022. The Law of Mosaics was the second of Pam's ballets to join the City Ballet repertory after her 2019 Bartok Ballet, which was set to Béla Bartók's String Quartet No. 5. Tanowitz set The Law of Mosaics to a score of the same name by the composer Ted Hearn. Hearn's music was partly inspired by a line from a book by David Shields about arts and culture in the digital age called Reality Hunger, a Manifesto. That line reads as follows. The Law of Mosaics, How to Deal with Parts in the Absence of Wholes. In this score, Ted Hearn wove together his own musical ideas with fragments from existing compositions, like Barber's Adagio for Strings and Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, and he stretched the technical and expressive capacities of the string orchestra. With Ted Hearn's music, Pam choreographed a richly layered work for 10 dancers, with costumes by Reed Bartlemy and Harriet Jung, and lighting by Brandon Sterling Baker. I recently sat down with two members of this ballet's original cast, current New York City Ballet soloist Miriam Miller, and recently retired New York City Ballet principal dancer Russell Jansen. We had a wide-ranging conversation. Miriam and Russell shared insights into Pam Tanowitz's creative process, their perspectives on the Law of Mosaics, how Pam's work relates to City Ballet's repertory and performance style, and the ways that Pam's generosity, playfulness, and intellectual rigor have informed their dance work. Pam has often said that the dancers play a very dignified role in her work, and you will hear that in this discussion. Pam draws on the qualities and imagination of her dancers in a powerful way, and you will hear about a whole chorus of these dancer collaborators, including Sarah Mearns, Melissa Toogood, Adrian Danchig-Waring, Dylan Crossman, Devin Alberta, Preston Shambly, and more. It is clear from both Miriam and Russell that Pam honors her dancers, and they honor her. Let's listen in. Miriam Miller, Russell Jansen, welcome to the Hear the Dance podcast. It's a great pleasure to be with the two of you.
Thank you, Silas.
We didn't want to talk over each other.
Thanks, Silas.
I'm very happy to be here.
Great. Yeah, nice to be here.
And we also have Russell's really cute dog with us, Una.
Yeah, she's chewing on a bully stick right now.
I love it. Dogs are a very beloved part of the New York City Ballet community and feature largely in class and rehearsal and the history of the company, because Jerome Robbins and others also really love dogs. So it feels very fitting that we have a dog with us as we record. I love it.
Yes.
Today, we're looking at Pam Tanowitz's ballet, The Law of Mosaics, which came into the rep in the spring of 2022. And it's to music of Ted Hearn. And it was her second piece for City Ballet after the first one being Bartok Ballet. And Miriam, you were part of Bartok Ballet and have a lot of insight into that. And Russell, you've worked with Pam both inside City Ballet and outside of City Ballet. So I'm interested to hear y'all's thoughts about working with Pam on a lot of different levels. But I thought I would start by asking the two of you, how did you first meet Pam and when did you first see her work?
I remember seeing Pam at City Center when she was in charge of studio rentals, I think was her position for a long time. And when I did gigs with Tom Gold when I was younger, she would come and watch sometimes. And I think I probably met her then. But the first time I actually met her was for the Dance Space platform in, I want to say, 2014 or 2015. And it had been a lot of collaborations between Cunningham dancers and Balanchine dancers, or people from both those lineages, as well as Judson Church And I think that Pam's event was like a culminating thing where there were City Ballet dancers and former Merce Cunningham dancers, Melissa Toogood and Dylan Crossman, who are two dancers who've danced with Pam a lot. Mm. And Pam like built a dance in a day. And she didn't really, like, we met before.
I see.
I mean, she did, but I think what we did was we each met with her individually so that she could just see us dance and like get a sense of how we moved. And she like asked us to take her through the alphabet. She had like a ballet dictionary. And so she was like, okay, A, arabesque. Okay, so can you do an arabesque for me? And then it was like B, ballinet. And so he was like, okay, this combination is like A, arabesque, B, ballinet, C, coupe, D, décolleté. You know, and then it's like that's how the phrase that we built that day in the studio. And I don't remember if that wound up being in the piece, but then in that day, we were each asked to bring in steps from our favorite ballet and teach it to everyone else. So great. I think Melissa maybe taught us something from, I want to say, Rainforest.
Okay.
And I taught a little bit of David's Bundlertanz, and Devin taught a little bit of Agon, and we would have like little pieces. And anyone could come in and watch her building it throughout the day, and then there were two performances at the end. So that was my first experience with Pam, the first time I met her. Yeah.
For me, I think my first time ever meeting her was for her first commission with City Ballet. So it was 2019. Yeah, I guess the spring season of 2019. I think I might have met her the previous year in Vail because I did a Cunningham piece, and I think she choreographed, or Melissa Toogood did one of her pieces that summer, but I didn't actually get to work with her. I didn't know her well enough to engage with her. But so then for Bartok that spring, I remember it being more of a rushed process because she was supposed to choreograph in the fall. And then I guess City Ballet reached out and said, hey, someone just dropped out. Can you choreograph for the spring? And she's not somebody that wants to rush her process. So she ended up using, I think, a lot of material from an ABT workshop that she then pulled phrases from there and had her assistants come in and teach us in the spring. And so in comparison to Law of Mosaics, Bartok was, it was still collaborative, but it was a lot more phrase learning. And it felt like we were, we were learning off of videos that had been previously recorded from dancers that had this work made already on them. But this was my first introduction to her and to, her energy in the studio. And we really built a relationship, though, from there, where that summer I worked with her in Vail and she made a piece. And then the following year, we were going to be doing her next ballet, which I knew I'd be working with her again. And then it just, this relationship every year continued with her just from that first moment with Bartok. And at the beginning of Bartok, I would have never imagined that me and Pam would build such a strong collaborative relationship. But I think that we really took to one another in the studio and outside. I mean, I've like rode with the car and in the car with her up to Vail. And it's just, we have become friends inside and outside. And yeah, it's been a really special relationship that is formed just from her making a ballet at City Ballet.
I love it. And what were your initial impressions of Pam, either as a person or getting to know her movement at the different points when you first met her?
For me, I think that I really learned a lot about myself in the process with working with her, in that you can collaborate with the person in the front of the room. I think for me, I hadn't had as much experience. I was still new in the company, in the core. It was my first few years in the core still. And when it came to new commissions, I would never feel comfortable like speaking out or talking more in conversation with the choreographer. And I think I was more insecure with myself as an artist. And through Pam, I was able to learn about who I am as an artist. And she really taps into the individuality of each person she's working with in the studio. And I was lucky enough to have a lot of one-on-one time with her. And just through these years, I've had this one-on-one time. And it doesn't feel like work. And what comes out of it is like, I mean, I think it's unplanned. It's not that she doesn't go into the studio with phrases. It's just what comes out of me and her's relationship. It made me feel like it's okay to be the type of artist I want to be and the way that I want to fall out of something or I want to move, just how my body reacts is what she plays with and what she feeds into. And that was, it was just eye-opening in my own experience with expression and artistry as a personal development.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
How about for you, Russell?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of to what Miriam is saying, Pam is, you know, one of the most generous people in the studio in that she really does come in without, like, this is what I want this to look like. She certainly comes in with ideas. She comes in with inspiration, and she comes in with references, and she comes in with feeling and music and like something that she's working towards. But it's, there's so much space for whoever is in the room in this way that I think, you know, because of the pace of things at City Ballet, it can sometimes be hard. So what I love about Pam is her, yeah, her generosity and then her kind of like curiosity and her desire to like learn and explore. It doesn't feel like she's teaching you something or setting something on you or telling you what's right or wrong. She's like figuring something out, and she like really relishes that. And I never feel like she needs to show that she knows what she's doing in a way that I think is very rare for anyone in the ballet world. I think we're all like trained to pretend like we know what we're doing long before we actually do. And instead, it's this like really playful, like generous spirit that creates a very different environment and leads to a feeling in the studio that I think is really, was really rare for me as a dancer.
Yeah.
Another point just that made me think of is Pam to me challenges the ideals that we have as ballet dancers of perfectionism and of what a finished product needs to look like, whether it be the piece in general and the dance that she's creating, or whether it be my approach to a step or my approach to a pas de deux, whatever it is. It's like she doesn't want the perfect line, or she doesn't want that perfectionism, and she wants it to be a continuous process where even Bartok, when she came and staged it for the second season that we did it, it completely changed. It became like a whole new ballet. And I'm curious now when we begin doing Law of Mosaics for this season, what will adjust, because it's so much about the people that are doing the piece and who's in the studio and even what studio are you in, whether you're, I mean, she loves a prop too. So whether we were in Nantucket or in Vail or outside, she uses the environment around her. And I was carrying a Nantucket bag because we were in Nantucket and like things like that. Or there's a tree all of a sudden on the stage. And it's, again, she's not seeking this finished like product or this finished creation. I think that it's about the process. And for me, as I've my time in the company, what I enjoy the most is the process and the time spent in the studio and with the colleagues and the people you're working with. And it's about those relationships. And Pam highlights that. And that's meaningful to her. And that's valuable to her. And yeah.
With the playing with the environment, I think back to a moment that of your choreography in Bartok where you really play with the environment of the theater.
Yes,
could
the
you talk about that?
I think it was, again, to probably the first time we were on stage. I mean, this was never something that Pam had ever talked about in the studio as part of the choreography. I think originally I was just in the front corner of the studio. And then we get on stage, and it's her first time, too, kind of on stage in the theater. And she looks out, and she sees these prosceniums on the side of the stage. And she goes over to stage management, and she asks, can we use that? Are we allowed to stand on that part of the stage? And I think they didn't have an answer. Nobody has ever asked that before. So I think they had to go to the powers above and see if that was a possibility. And then it turns out that it was. And so she, yeah, has me walk out, like, past the orchestra pit. I'm on the side next to the quartet that was playing, actually, and hold on to the gold proscenium in my gold leotard.
Yeah, you're
and do a
camouflaged. Yeah, with the Reed and Harriet's wonderful gold costumes.
And again, then it gives me a different perspective, too, of performance and of just, yeah, being a performer. And I'm interacting more than with the musicians, with the audience. That was also my first experience with, again, playing with the environment that's around you. And in Long Mosaics, I think the wings are, I just thought of this, but the wings are white and see-through, and we're standing halfway in that see-through wing doing partnering steps. And yeah, she uses the whole stage. She sees the bigger picture. And again, with like the way she organizes her ballets, she sees the bigger picture of what, how do you feel at the end of it? Like, where does this section go? And yeah, I mean, she's a very intelligent choreographer.
I think that the Wings in Law of Mosaics is actually the Episodes.
Episodes Wings.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She loves Episodes. Yeah. That's one of her favorite ballets.
But that's a cool through line.
Yeah.
The kind of sleek abstraction of Balanchine's Episodes.
Yeah.
With those white wing legs.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of environment, during COVID, you worked really closely with Pam on a piece that ended up being very much in response to the environment in which you made the piece and then to the place where y'all filmed the piece. Could you speak a little bit about that process?
Russell? Yeah. So we had, like Miriam was saying, the ballet that was, who knows what it would have been had COVID not happened, but we started working on her next ballet in February of 2019 at the end of the winter season. 2020. Sorry, February of 2020, the end of the winter season. And I was coming back from an ankle injury, and Pam was like, I really want to start. Can you just come in? So she made like a very subdued dance for me then, but I like traveled a lot across the main hall. Like I think I have a video somewhere and I'm just kind of like doing deep like pliés across. I'm doing like my PT exercises.
I love it.
And I think Sarah and I maybe had a duet that she built a little bit. I think you...
I started a little bit. None of it became what became her next commission, but yeah, we had a whole solo already mapped out.
But yeah, we had like a bunch of work that she had created, and then when lockdown happened, Pam was like, I can't stop. I need to keep going. And so I think with a couple of her dancers and then with me, she would work one-on-one on FaceTime.
Mm.
And we built like 10 or 12 minute long solo over the course of a couple months on FaceTime in the different apartments that I'd been staying in, on my like dance mat that we got through the company, my like piece of Marley.
Little piece of Marley.
Square.
Yeah. And so we made this whole solo that was like contained to this dance mat. And at a certain point, she was like, I think it's done. Like, we'll see what it gets used for. And then when the company came to her with their idea for the digital fall gala,
yeah,
she was like, well, I actually already have something that I made with Russell. Maybe we can do that. So it changed a lot.
Hmm.
All the choreography was from that solo that we had developed. But then I think it's called... I'm like embarrassed to say solo for Russell.
Solo for Russell, sites 1 through 5.
No big deal. Solo for Russell. Solo for Russell, sites 1 through 5. And so we moved all over the Lincoln Center campus. I started on like that grass lawn, the sloping lawn above the Lincoln restaurant. And then I was in are those Calder sculptures out front of the library?
Yeah.
I think they're Calder sculptures. And then I was on the side of the theater. And then I was in the band shell. And I did little bits of the dance and I like undressed and then put on a different costume, the beautiful Reed and Harriet costumes. And so that it went from being something that was contained into like a 5x7 square to being like the entire Lincoln Center campus, basically. And then that solo became the material that made up the solo that I do in Law of Mosaics. So it got changed a lot because my knee was bad when we performed it on stage. So a lot of things were changed and, you know, it developed over time like all of Pam's stuff does. But the solo that I do in Law of Mosaics is like downstage left the whole time. I don't actually move that much. So I kind of stay in this space. Yeah. So that was so responded to the environment in all different ways. And
yeah. And so cool that it's like one thread from what she started before the pandemic, and then it became a film, a beautiful film, Ezra Hurwitz, and then incorporated into this next piece on stage.
Yeah, it was, I don't remember if it was the last time I did it on stage, but it felt like a really big deal. I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, a lot had happened, you know, for everyone in that time. There's this part where I, like, the way it was built was Pam would send me series of pictures, and I'd have to make a phrase built on those series of historical dance pictures. So there's, like, a Catherine Dunham pose in it. There's Merce Cunningham. There's Mary Wegman. I think that's how you say her last name. There's I gave her pictures of Adam Luters and like all. And then she would give me phrases of words, like a rose is a rose, I think was one of the cues. So there's all these different cues that would then lead to the creation of a phrase. And then she would change things or be like, I don't like that. Let's skip this one or whatever. And there's this one part that was a response to someone doing a pike jump.
Okay.
It's like, you know, they're basically touching their toes in the air. And I was like, well, I'm not going to, I can't do that ever. I've never been able to do that. And B, I'm certainly not going to like work on doing that in like my apartment.
during quarantine.
So I think I broke it into like I like touch one toe, then I touch the other toe, then I bend down, and then I sit down on the floor. And I remember doing that in one of the shows, and I like, it's like hard on your hamstrings. But I started like, I got so emotional just thinking about like, I did this in like so many different apartments during COVID. I've gone through like personal upheaval in that time. I'm like, you know, there's all these things. And I was like, I'm so happy that I'm doing this on stage and like doing this thing that Pam and I had talked about for so long. And it felt like it never like quite felt like we had got to do it. And then, you know, the film was great, but it was also like, you know, it's a film. No one was there really. We were all wearing masks off. You know, it was just like so many things. And
But then to bring all of that through to something that you offered up on the stage.
Yeah.
That's really special.
Yeah. And Pam, while we were building the solo, like invited me to write about it as well. So I was also like writing about it and sharing my writing about it with her while we were making the dance. And that also fed into the solo. So it just, it felt like, you know, I just think Pam is like the best and I just love her so much. And it felt like so, it felt like such a gift for me. And also like I loved doing things that Pam was excited about. So like to feel like Pam was excited about this thing that we had been working on for so long, I just like, it's so lovely to get to do her work.
When it sounds like she just draws so deeply on the individual dancers.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes it so memorable for each individual dancer that works with her, is she connects with you in a way that I think you don't realize until after the fact. And then you leave these experiences with so many beautiful memories and funny memories. And because she also in the rehearsal studio is goofy and she is walking around barefoot and trying to do ballet steps and trying to name ballet steps that she doesn't know, and she is asking you to invert things, and she's asking you to like, oh, what's this, or I saw this on stage, what's that, can you do it backwards, can you do it upside down, like she has, it's a playground in a way, as you're playing with this vocabulary that we do every single day. And then with her background and all of her historical knowledge that she comes in with, and it just creates a very fulfilling process.
I love it. What are some of the ways you feel you've reconsidered your own ballet technique or come to different understanding about ballet technique through the way that she's worked with you?
It kind of goes again to her challenging the ideals of perfectionism, of like challenging turnout and challenging what is an Italian fouetté. It makes me think of La Mosaics. What is an Italian fouetté supposed to look like? And I think she might have seen us do it in class or something. Or I mean, we also never do them on the stage at City Ballet, really. And I don't know where she came up with it, but she was like, can you do it the other way? Has that ever been done? Do you ever do that? And it's like, I've never tried, but I'll try. And that's the thing too, is with Pam, when you're in the studio, at least for me, it's an opportunity to just try something new. Like, let's try to do this turning the other direction. Instead of my foot going back into a back attitude, it's going to go into a front attitude. And I'm going to do it then facing the back corner and then the side corner. And then I'm going to go into tombe coupe jetés. It's like these combinations that we wouldn't typically put together, and these shapes that you wouldn't typically expect an attitude or a tendu or something to look like, whether you're doing it turned in or I guess parallel, or you're facing a different direction, and so it makes the line look different. It kind of skews it in a way, and it manipulates it. Yeah, I don't know if you have more to add on that.
Yeah, no, I think I've had a similar experience with working with her movement. And also, she really, like, challenges what performing means, too. Like, I think there's this way that, like, we all dance at City Ballet that we tell ourselves that we're not doing a performance. We're like, this is the most obvious way to do a step. And it's like, actually, it's really not. Like,
it's highly stylized.
It's so stylized. Everyone's like, this is the cleanest way. And you're like... Yeah. It's clean, but it's not the cleanest way. And with Pam, it was, and I don't mean that it's, you know, there's no judgment.
It's a beautiful stylistic distinctiveness.
Yes.
But it's still stylistic
distinctiveness. Absolutely. And I think sometimes we really get caught up in it at City Ballet in this way that I don't think we always are so aware of.
And that's interesting.
And there's like a way of performing, and I think it kind of like goes in waves depending on who is dancing a lot. You know, like I feel like when I first got in, there's this way of dancing that I always connected to Janie Taylor that really like infused a lot of the dancers at that time. And I think like there's, you know, there's all different people at different times. And I think that Pam doesn't want you to perform and doesn't want you to, she wants to kind of like strip it bare in some way. And that's like not quite the right way to say it, because I think like every individual person, like what Miriam was saying, is so important. That it's not that she wants to take away an individuality. She wants to reveal it in a very different way than how we're used to revealing our individuality when we're doing a Balanchine ballet or even a Robbins ballet or one of Justin's ballets. And maybe that's a better way to say it, because I think it's like, you know, Pam's is just as stylized in a different way. But it's like it did for me really challenge what it meant to perform. And I think, especially having done a lot of like roles that require a lot of like bravura or presence or a certain like romantic affect, it felt like so like sexy and cool to just be like, I'm just gonna look to the corner and not tilt my head at all and not try and look like a man or like a prince or like I'm mad or like I'm in love, and just I'm just gonna look at the corner and like focus on what I'm doing and show exactly what the choreography is without trying to inhabit it in any way other than what it takes to do the step.
That's fascinating.
That, yeah, it's like we add affect and these Balanchinian impulses or tendencies, I guess, that we've learned through our training. And I think for us, it's so natural. And it's like you go and you put your arm up, or you go to a quasi position and you use your head, you give a paumant. And I think that it's just a reaction. And even with where the height of our arms are and using a hand that shows every single finger, and we have broken, I mean, especially me, I've got broken wrists that just flop down, and she doesn't want any of that. It's a straight line. And she looks for these clean lines that have no extra like ballet impulse, I guess, or style weaved within it. And I think that's also a challenge with her work, is you can't just do what you would normally do when you go to do a tendu. Like, she doesn't want you to do it the way that you would stand at bar and you do it. She wants to see other possibilities within that step. How else can we make it look? And I think Russell reminded me too, when you think of the aspect of performing, she would say, do it like you're marking it, like it's you're giving it too much energy or you're trying too hard, like just mark it. And that look is what she was going for. And so for us, it's like the thought of marking something out on the David Koch Theater, you're like, I would never in front of thousands of people. And
you sure you don't want me to get my leg a little bit higher?
Yeah, you're like, you sure about that? Yeah, and like your feet are flopping, you're flexing your feet. But it's like you're letting yourself react to just, you're just reacting in a different way to the movement and to the performance aspect of like turning your head. She's like, if you're not in line, you turn your head and you look to see where you are. You look, you find your spacing on the floor. You don't have to like fisheye it. She hates it if you're fisheyeing or you're using your peripherals. She's like, just turn your head, just look. And it creates such a community on the stage, because you have to be constantly in tune with everyone else around you. And you're not counting anything. A lot of it is all visual as well. And so you're going off of, okay, when this dancer finishes this sequence, that's when I start. Or when this dancer moves this arm, that's my cue to go. And so it's similar to Cunningham in a way, as it's timed. And so she has these pieces of music, and if we don't finish by the end, it's like, okay, we're going to do this phrase a little bit faster in order to get there at the end. Like before I start my solo in La Mosaics, it ends kind of in this more, it picks up speed and we go a lot quicker just in order to get to the end of the music in the right time. But again, it's a lot of like interacting with people on stage in the present moment. And some shows at Bar Talk especially felt different every single time I performed it, and the timing was different. And that's a very unique experience as a Balanchine dancer that we don't get to experience Yeah. It's a very unique way of performing.
It sounds like it's reorienting your relationship to time and your relationship to space. Because even hearing you say that, I've never really thought about it. But it's like, yeah, we're trained to veil our need to orient ourselves in space. You keep your same outwardly oriented épaulement and you fisheye to stay in that line. You know what I mean?
It's like nobody can know that I'm trying to stay in the line,
but we have to stay in the line, but continue to offer up ourselves oriented towards the front.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And Pam's stuff isn't always oriented towards the front.
The facings are so varied.
I feel when I'm watching Pam too, everyone's on their own journey too. Like they're all in this community and they're all in it together and we're just these viewers watching from above, but everyone has a unique journey throughout it, and they're at times doing something completely different than these other group of dancers over here. And I think there's just a lot that can be dissected in her work, because it makes me wonder, and not that I know much, but it makes me wonder about what, when she is creating a ballet, like what is going on in your mind, what are you seeing, or what are you thinking, what is it makes me curious of what she's seeing when she watches, and how is she interpreting the piece, and how is she interpreting, because I think everyone has a different interpretation of the works that she does, because it's very much open to how you see it as an individual and who you're watching, whose track are you paying attention, more attention to.
Now, with that kind of breaking down, or at least inviting you to reconsider your own relationship to your, as you said so well, your balletic impulses and your movement, how did you initially respond to what she was asking of you physically or intellectually in the rehearsal process?
I mean, I remember doing the dance space platform thing. She also told me not to break my wrists. I remember we did like a grand jeté to one side, grand jeté to the other, and she wanted us to just keep our arms straight and our hands straight out. And she was like, Russell, don't bend your wrists. And I was like mad. I was like, I'm not bending my wrists. And then like I look to see what I was doing. And like when we land, we automatically like have
subtly
this like
absorb the air.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? We do a little plié with our wrists.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, interesting. So I feel like that was really eye opening. That whole process actually, it made me a lot more cognizant of how I use my hands and when it is important to emphasize these things that we've really been trained to do through being at SAB and in the company, and when it might be effective to not do that or like bring it in later or something. So I think I was like, and I was like annoyed at her. I was like, what do you mean? Like, this is how I do it, and this is, what's wrong with that? Why are you singling me out? And then, but then I think like as you kind of understand what it is that excites Pam, then you're like, I want to figure out how to do something that's going to make Pam delighted. Like, I just want to delight Pam in the studio. And I feel like there are all these things when she does something, when she comes in, she's like, I'm obsessed with pas de chaise right now. Like, let's do something with pas de chaise. And then you're like, ooh, what can I do to make Pam, like, I want Pam to pick my thing. And you're like,
like my exploration of pas de chaise.
And not like in a competitive way. I mean, a little bit, I guess. You know, we are ballet dancers. But like, when you are starting to understand, when you start to think you understand Pam's thinking, which you can't really, or I didn't feel like I could, it's like, it's fun because it feels expansive. You're like one of the cues that she gave me once was tap, tap, tap. And I was like, what can I do that Pam won't expect? And it made me just like think very differently. So, yeah.
That's so great.
I
love that.
That's a good answer.
Thanks, Mary.
I think for me, it also tapped into like my strength, I guess, like in stabilizing, or how do you do this step not using the same muscles or the same like approach as you would, like how can you do this stand, I mean, because her work is very challenging, it's very hard and athletic and like requires a lot of control, and so doing these steps that we think we know how to do, or we do them every day in class and you'd think like I should be able to do this turn, this pirouette, or this penché, or this arabesque. But as soon as you change where your head is in relation to your body or your arm, it changes your weight, it changes your balance. And I think that was also a fun exploration within my own kind of relationship with ballet and with dance, and getting to explore movement in my own body in a different way. And it was hard. Like, it was a challenge. And I remember just being extremely challenged by it and working on it. And again, you want to be good and you want to be like, have Pam be impressed by you. So it just gives you an opportunity to challenge yourself and try something new.
I do think that like Miriam and I are also people who like really value like thinking in like how we move through life. Like I know, you know, like during COVID, Miriam was doing like 4 or 5 classes at a time, even when she like came, even right after when she came back to work and like
school class.
You're both, classes,
you're both
sorry.
Very academically
I think we're,
people.
I think we both like thinking a lot and sometimes there are seasons when you're not as challenged in the rep and you don't get to think about what you're doing either because you've done it so much or you're not cast in that much. And something that Pam's dancing really offers, because it challenges all these things about ballet and asks you to do a tendu and then like rotate it and then do something backwards, is like you kind of have to think the whole time. And so it does tap into this thing that I think, like, I think Miriam and I have to like think about how to do ballet sometimes. Like there's some,
it's not that easy.
Right. Like, you know, there are some people that we've danced with who like don't have to think.
Their movement is so natural.
Yeah. And that's not to say that they don't.
Different approach.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not to say that they don't think. They are so thoughtful, but they are like so effortlessly coordinated that they don't have to think about how to do a step sometimes. And I do think that Miriam and I sometimes have to think, you know, we've danced together. Sometimes we have to think about how to not knock each other over.
Yeah.
And it's like really rewarding to have choreography that is like, you have to think. And Miriam, we're like, thank God, because we've been thinking this whole time.
Yes, now we get to think.
We can put it to practice in that's a different
actually
way
really,
in the choreography.
Yeah, I've never thought about it in that way, but maybe that's why I respond so positively to it. And it feels good in my body because it requires thinking. And yes, sometimes when you think too much in a balancing ballet, it sabotages you. Yeah. And it doesn't, at least, for me and you both, it doesn't work to our favor. And with Pam, it really does. And it requires that. Yeah. That's something I never thought about, but it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Like, I feel like when we did Agon together, we spent so much time thinking and talking about it. And I think, kind of like in the end, it was actually better when we were just like,
when I got COVID and we just had to do it the week after I came
back.
A little bit.
It was like,
I swear I'm still in shape.
Yeah, it was like, let's just do
let's
it.
Just do
let's
it.
Just do
and
it.
And
yeah.
in a way, it was like,
better.
Oh, maybe we should have just done that from the start.
Yeah, totally.
But that y'all's more intellectually rigorous approach really resonates with the actual structure of how Pam's dances work,
which is really gratifying.
And that must be also a big reason why she's drawn to both of you, that there's a.
Yeah, maybe.
I think up for that exploration, or like she wants to talk to you in the studio, and some people don't want to have that conversation in the studio.
I mean, and I will also say that Miriam and I like really like talking too, and Pam like really likes to talk. So it's like we're a great match in the studio because we're just like we'll talk the whole time.
But yeah, I mean, Pam comes in with an idea, and even I think of the solo, which was actually a double duet for Mira and I in Law of Mosaics. It was supposed to be a silent double duet. Mira got COVID the week of the premiere, and she made it a solo. And so that section, though, is in silence, and Pam hasn't choreographed immensely in point shoes. She's a modern dance choreographer. Right, and so for her exploring the point shoe, she came in with this idea this day, and it was really just to explore what can we do with the point shoe? How can we make noise? Because it's going to be in silence. Yeah. Let's make noise on every single point of the point shoe. So what we were talking about, she has these thoughtful, very thoughtful ideas, and then that's how she creates, and that's all it takes. And then with the dancers that are in front of her and their own openness to creating and exploring this idea with her and talking about it and informing her, and she's informing us, and then that's what creates the ballet you see on stage, and the movement.
Which is so cool, too, thinking about that, because, again, we place such a high premium on having silent point shoes through most of the rep. So then to have it really be a strategic choice to try to see what percussive possibilities there are with the point shoot, to hear it, hear what it's like an instrument in that way.
That's true, yeah.
I thought it would be fun to just kind of fly over the different movements of the ballet and just hear any thoughts y'all have about the making of those particular sections or images that Pam may have given you for the sections. So the piece begins, the ballet has a musical score called The Law of Mosaics by the composer Ted Hearn, and each of the movements has a very evocative title. So the first movement is called Excerpts from the Middle of Something. That's the name of that part of the music. And it starts with a men's trio, and then it kind of introduces you to the members of the cast over the course of it. And then it goes into Miriam's silent solo, which you've just described was actually supposed to originally be a duet for you and Mira Nadon. Then the second movement is called Palindrome for Andrew Norman. I can't remember from the playbill if she actually writes out the names of the movements of the music. I don't think she does. I think she just lists the name of the music. And then that's a duet for Russell and Sarah. And so could you talk to us a little bit about that second movement?
Yeah, I was glad that Miriam brought up that thing about Mira, if that's okay to go back a little bit, because I think that also like speaks to Pam's genius. Like, love letter to Pam is what this podcast episode should be called.
As it should be.
But the that duet, like, part of me kind of hopes that she brings it back for this season.
I think she is.
She is, okay. Because it was like, it was like camera music and Barocco and all, and like the two women in Apollo, the two muses in Apollo. There's like, it was all these things that I was like watching it. I was like, oh my God, I want to see Mira and Miriam dance everything next to each other. And like, there was something about the way that Pam paired the two of you together that was just like, so it, like, everyone was so thrilled every time they got to watch it in the studio. And then also when it was a solo, it became thrilling in a totally different way. It was like, I think it went from being this like exercise in unison, because I think you two really had to focus to stay together, this exercise in unison and precision and like, and like kind of a getting rid of an individual ego in order to do this very challenging dance together, to this like Miriam just like commanding the stage in this really like dramatic and percussive solo. So I think it's really exciting that hopefully audiences will have got to see both the Miriam alone version and then hopefully the Miriam and Mira version too. And I do think that there was something about Miriam and Mira together that was very exciting to watch as well.
And side note, Mira is another extremely thoughtful dancer. She's somebody that, and it's funny just from what you've said, because it's true that the way the movement reads, or how a dancer approaches Pam's choreography with that thoughtfulness, really shows. And Mira, I think, has a similar thoughtfulness in her dancing that we've described. And perhaps that is what also makes then a duet like this, where you have to, you're completely in tune with one another. Yeah. And for me and her, it's not like we're trying to like up one another, you know, it's about what we're doing together. And I love that. And I think that it's something we don't always get to explore. And Pam also saw maybe the way that we interacted in the studio together, how we even moved, because we were in the core all the time together. And so we're the tall girls, you've got to move with them. And so I think of that with Emmy too, Emily Kikta. We know how to dance similarly and move similarly because we've spent so much time together side by side in the core. And I think that's the power of Mira and I doing that duet, is it all comes from this history, you know, of us and the time we've spent in the studio for a couple of years together. Yeah, and Pam picked up on that. Whether it was intentional or not, I don't know if she read into that at all, but it, I think, is what made it such a striking moment within the ballet. And for it to be in silence. We don't do a lot of ballets in silence.
Right. What's interesting, because it makes me jump around in my thoughts, we don't have to go in the perfect order of the movements, because it makes me remember that, again, in the first movement of the piece, the music really does stop and start and stop and start. And there's choreography in the silence that connects the starting and the stopping. And so the way that she plays with silence in a way that sounds like it makes you all have to have like a heightened sensory perception of the other people on the stage. Could y'all talk a little bit about that?
And just to jump off of that, the internal metronome, similar with the first movement, whether there's music or not, the second movement in silence, but it's, you have this metronome of this constant rhythm. And honestly, I don't hear the music so much when I'm dancing Pam's work because I'm constantly thinking of the steps and I'm thinking of the choreography and not counting, but you're so in tune with the internal rhythm that you and your fellow dancers on the stage have.
Yeah.
And I'm not completely sure how to articulate that, but it's what drives the entirety of the each movement. And each movement has a different feel, whether it's the pas de deux that comes later, where it's softer and it doesn't have this like constant, I
like
don't
a
know.
Relentlessness to
yeah,
the music.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, yeah, and in that first one, I feel like we're all exploring each other. Like we're looking at each other like, oh, hey, you're here too. I'm looking at Daniel or Adrian and I walk out on stage and I'm like, oh, you made it. Or like, oh, nice to see you. Okay, let's dance. Like, let's do this together. Or like, oh, Chris is going to go do some arabesques. And then, oh, I'll try. You know, it's this conversation. Yeah. And having that dialogue in your head is also the fun of it.
That's really interesting. It's like a different kind of thought process than you're having when you're in the midst of a ballet where it's highly musically structured, where you're counting everything and you know everything is in certain bars of the music and the music is your impulse a lot of the time. It sounds like the movement and really like seeing and recognizing each other is maybe more
but
of
with
impulse.
A blasé face.
Right.
You don't react at all. And that's Pam's humor is you're not showing.
Although I do think you could smile and it would be fine.
Yeah. I mean, but not like a
right. Like, it's not you're not performing smiling.
It's a smile because
it's an acknowledgement.
you're with like it's like if I walked onto the stage and I saw Russell, I could not smile. Like, or I could not make a warming. Like, he has such a warming presence and face. You acknowledge your relationship with that person, and that is okay, or that I think Pam doesn't mind. But as soon as it goes to the performing aspect of Pam's work, as soon as it's a performative and like. Like you're doing it for the audience and your ego begins to come through, that's when it doesn't read and Pam doesn't like it. I mean, it's not what her work is about. Yeah. Not to diverge. But
no, not at all. And then it's kind of fun to jump from that. So there's that first movement, people are being introduced, music is coming in and out, and you're keeping the internal metronome. Then there's the silent section, which is either a Miriam solo or a Miriam Mira duet. Then there's the second movement for Russell and Sarah that is, there's a duet, and then there's the solo material that you developed during the pandemic. I think that duet is super interesting. Could you share with us about that? It feels like it has so many moments of for all of what we just said about like maybe less emotional dancing, I think there's a lot of tenderness in its own kind of way in that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, God, I don't even know if I remember the duet. I do think that Pam had worked with both Sarah and I individually during COVID and like she knew that there would be a solo for me and a solo for her in the dance at different points that we're going to somehow like anchor the piece in some way.
Yeah.
And then there is the duet that she made for us. And there are moments of tenderness. And I think like she made it at a time when Sarah and I had developed a real comfort with one another. And I think there are times, like I think there's a moment when Sarah like leans her head on my shoulder and she probably just had like done that in one rehearsal. And so I think that that kind of like ease with one another was like really built in and Pam's ease with the two of us. And I think that so much of that dance, I think, was also just like made around like what's not going to hurt my knee because I had a tear in my patellar tendon then. Yeah. And I was like not really I wasn't doing anything else, I don't think. And yeah, I'm trying to think of other moments in it that are interesting. Like there's this one moment where Sarah runs her hand down my leg and Pam like called it like a sexy moment. But I think it's, like, really not sexy. Like, it doesn't look sexy. I think it's just, like, she's just, like, running her hand down my leg. Very, like, matter of fact and, like, we're doing things together. And, like, you know, for me, dancing with Sarah, like, was always, like, risked turning into giggling. And I think that that duet both used that and was a challenge.
Yeah.
You know?
The underlying playfulness and the... Yeah. Challenge to be very composed.
Right. Like, I think there were moments where there was a moment where we do Pam's favorite at the time, like a broken up pas de deux, and we have to like sustain something. And for some reason, the way that we had to sustain a passe, it was like hard to balance. And it was like, Pam wanted us to like pull it out. And Sarah, of course, is like facing upstage. So she gets to be like, give me a face like, whoa. And I like have to not do that back. But I think that there is some, you know, there's some, something about that added something maybe. I don't know.
And there's some cool moments in the choreography, like one of you promenades the other, and then the other one promenades the other.
Oh, yeah,
you really
I think
share the load right. of the partnering work. In
yeah,
a kind of
I think Sarah
cool
had to like
way.
Partner me while I'm doing like a quarter fouette turn.
That's right.
Which was hard.
Yeah.
But that would have been hard for me to do for, yeah. you know, partnering people for a long time. It is very reciprocal, which is really how like dancing with Sarah felt for me a lot, that she has such like presence and strength. And it did feel like we a lot of times were like that she was also kind of dancing me around the stage, and that this I wouldn't say that this is like a dancey duet, but it was us moving one another around the stage. Yeah,
that's super cool. And then it goes into the wonderful material that you described before that y'all had developed during COVID. And then it goes to the third movement, which is called Climactic Moments from Adagio for Strings and the Four Seasons, slowed down and layered on top of one another, which is another way of saying that
wow.
the composer actually took sections from Barber's Adagio for Strings and Vivaldi's The Four Seasons and just really slowed them down and pulled them apart and made a really interesting framework where Pam then made the couples section where you have all these simultaneous duets happening, which is very interesting. Any kind of memories from that duets part or
with that? I think of Pam's work and many of her duets or partnered work is you dancing side by side, or you have some moments touching, but it's not partnering in the way that maybe we think of partnering, like the diamonds pas de deux, you know, where the man is
lifts
partnering the woman and lifting
and
it, and the woman is always on point and never lifting the man. And I think that just the idea of partnering, she was exploring for herself in a different way in this section, because we all are coupled with somebody. And I was with Adrian, and whether I'm promenading him or I'm taking his leg or he's doing the same to me, we were connecting in a way that I had not done before through Pam's work. I had always danced side by side with people and always like in tandem with them, but never in a like pas de deux, in a
part,
like an actual pas de deux.
Yeah.
And so that was unique to explore with her. I think that she utilized phrases that she had that then how can we do this as a partnership? Like, how can we make it into a pas de deux?
Yeah.
Like, we have, you can do it on your own, but let's connect it with somebody else and use another body and see what that brings about. So that, I think, is showcased within that section. And it's slow, and so you can really see every moment. And it's like a magnifying glass, you know, or you're zoomed into to that work, and it's very clear, and it was fun.
It's cool. It's like she extends the material by deletion when when Mira gets injured and she takes something for two and makes it for one, and then she extends the movement by addition. What was a solo? Let's make that a duet.
Absolutely.
That's cool. The next section is called Beats, adapted from a song called The Weight that this composer Ted Hearn wrote in collaboration with Philip White, because Ted Hearn, he's a composition professor at USC, and he's a vocal artist, and he writes for classical music instruments, all this. And this was a piece he'd written in a more like electronic music kind of zone, but then he took it and rewrote it for the string orchestra for which this whole piece is written. Mm-hmm. But it's got a kind of, I don't know, almost like electric dance music kind of vibe to it, but it's on the string orchestra, mm-hmm. which is cool. And there's a lot of virtuosic steps, but I'd love to hear y'all talk about how Pam uses the virtuosic steps. Like Preston Chambly has to do alsa con turns, but mm-hmm. they're just very matter of fact. It's like he just comes and he does the alsa con turns, and then mm-hmm. he stops and he walks off. Just like you do coupe jetés seemingly out of nowhere at mm-hmm. one point, but it's not like she's putting those what we would consider more virtuoso steps for like a showing effect mm-hmm. at all. They're just vocabulary. Mm-hmm. I don't know what y'all might think about that.
I remember when I first saw that she had Preston doing alsa con turns, and I was like, is this tacky? And then like it's not because it's Pam, but I've only ever seen something like this put in a new work in a way that feels like of a piece with a gala moment or something, yeah. you know, because yeah. alsa con turns, I mean, I get, you know, diamonds, it's maybe a little bit different, the alsa con turns, but it's still, you finish and you get applause and it's like there's a big finish.
It's a flourish.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like kind of a, flourish. It's a peak, and there is something about how Preston does those alsa con turns that like neutralizes the bravura of it in this way that is not tacky, and not to say that all alsa con turns are tacky.
No, but it's like she's yeah. using them in a different way.
Yeah, and it's like cool to see how, because typically Pam is like interested in small steps, and she, I think in that, you know, I don't know that I would have necessarily picked that out on my own, but you're right, there's the coupe jeté turns. I think Adrian does a version of an agon coupe jeté kind of thing, mm-hmm. and is like a lot of big jumps, and a lot of Pam is a lot smaller than that, and she uses these big feats in the same way that she uses the small feats, and that's mm-hmm. pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And to Preston doing the alsa con turns, I think the way she frames it as well as where we're all, I think there's four of us on stage in a circle spaced out around him in a lunge watching him. Like, I think to mm-hmm. frame it in a way that it's not just him doing it to the audience. It's, again, still to us, because his front is not the audience. We're the ones around him watching him from all different viewpoints and, like, in the round. And I think that's what helps mute it, that it's not this performative act or grand movement. It's just, like, another step. And the way he just walks in, he just casually walks, okay, fourth, let's go. Yeah. And then he finishes, and we're like, okay, I'm going to do a C-Sone, or I'm going to do a Tama Flesh, you know? And I think, like, my turn, but not even. It's just like you're just dancing. You move on. And in that section, Russell reminded me of, she does have a lot more big jumps, and that's, mm-hmm. and I remember being so tired. By this point in the ballet, I was exhausted, and at the end of this section, I think Preston does alsa con turns again, and she had asked me to do them, and I was like, Pam, I just can't. It's like, my left leg is gone.
Preston did them again.
Yeah, but I think...
he does them so well.
But yeah, because she moves us all around the space in a much more grand way than you see in the first section. Mm-hmm. And same within Bartok. It was much more ensemble work, and we were all kind of together, whether we're doing the hoedown or mm-hmm. we're moving as a group. And this was us on our own tracks again, like largely moving around the space. And maybe it was too, she was familiar with the size of the Koch Theater, and she was able to play with space more because she had been familiarized with it, and like, oh, let's reach to the outer edges of the stage. And so it allowed for her to expand the vocabulary she used within the steps that she had, that she brought into the studio. And yeah, I think she expanded that vocabulary, and that expanded us.
So cool.
Not to negate what we just said, but I do also think that there's something about the matter of factness of it that also highlights what a feat it is, while also not, it's like, I think something that is so brilliant about Pam's work is that it shows off the beauty of the steps without being like, and now we're showing it off. And I think that's kind of what the alsa con turns are, is because Preston,
course.
Will always pull in for a triple pirouette, yeah, and yeah. his leg is always in a beautiful position out to the side, yeah. and he's always turned so sharply, and it's like such a pleasure to get to watch them, and you yeah. get to just be like, wow, cool.
Yeah.
And brilliant. But it's also like, and then it's a tongue flash, like, wow, cool.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
yeah. It's not, like it's not that
interesting.
It's, yeah, it's not that she's valuable. Flattening yeah. out things when she takes the bravura element out of it, which I think is kind of like in keeping with a Balanchinian ideal of like,
yeah.
you know, this, I think, you know, more or less people have told us versions of like, you don't want to make anything more or less than what it is. You know, I feel like when Rosemary taught me phlegmatic and four T's, she was like, do one step and then the next. She was like, finish a step before you go on to the next one. And I think there's that's also true with Pam. It's not like you're, she doesn't want you to rush ahead of yourself or like get yeah. too caught up. It's like you have to give everything its due, everything its weight.
That's really cool.
And don't add anything to the step, just do the step.
Yeah.
And whether it's the way Pam wants you to do the step or the way we do it with our Balanchine rep, you just do the choreography. And as soon as anything else is added to it, it's not what was perhaps intended.
Because it's enough.
Because it's enough, as it is.
The steps are substantive.
Yeah. And
yeah. the design
Yeah, and I think
crafty.
That's a relation between the two of them.
From that section with the virtuosity that we've been deliberating about, then there's a fifth movement called Climactic Moments from movement three times as slow as before, which sounds exactly like it is in terms of the music. And that starts with a wonderful solo that cuts different angles of the body for Ruby Lister and then goes into a trio section. And then it closes with a solo called The Warp and Woof for Sarah. And she has her take her point shoes off. And then she does this long solo that ends with lots of bores, just side and side, kind of hypnotically traversing the stage and doing a lot of very, to me, after having watched the rest of the ballet, it looks like somehow more emotional gestures, or I don't know if y'all have any more insights about that solo, but it feels like it's very... It feels like a fitting conclusion, but it does feel very apart from the rest of the ballet, but in a satisfying kind of way.
Yeah, I think that was another thing that was started during COVID through something at City Center.
Okay.
Pam and Sarah did a solo, built something together at City Center, and I think that's where that material came from. Mm. And I do think that, the Bore section involves like an accumulation of like mime gestures. Mm-hmm. Like there's something where... It's like Sarah's doing like boxing fists and she does like the death that crosses her wrists. Like I think she like accumulates. Oh yeah, she
prayer.
Does some sort of prayer.
Prayer hands.
Yeah, I think that there was like some exploration of mime gesture that is, you know, not telling a story, but is just the gesture of it or the shape of the mime, which I think is like, it's like kind of tied to how Pam does use Apama, like things that she doesn't want. It's like she's like, do the picture of it, not the affect of it. So it's like if you're tilting your head, you're not doing apama, you're like doing the picture of the head tilt, if that makes
sense.
That's
interesting. Like you're not trying to add more.
You're not
to,
trying you're just, to embody the apama.
You're just
like
angling your head.
Yeah.
Angling your torso.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's funny actually, because it reminds me of this moment in Bartok. When we would hit like a position, which is probably the picture of the position, and then we would freeze for a beat, and then we'd give the epama and the flourish, and we'd make our ballet hands and and do the opposite.
She's like, fine, I'll give it to
and
you.
And so I think, it makes me wonder if it was originally in the piece that she made with ABT, or if it was what she brought to us, and that was it was because she saw us adding that. I mean, it was all of our first time working with Pam, and we probably added it in a lot of her choreography, and she would have to tell us to stop doing it. And so it's kind of funny to think back on that she gave us a moment to let it go, but then you realize the difference too. You're like, oh, I can make
modulate
this,
that,
and then I can make it this other way. And But with Sarah's solo, yeah, when watching all of the gestures, to me it feels like a memory, or it feels like she's reminiscing on the past. And maybe because it was made through COVID, there were these different memories she was having, or whatever it may be. And I don't know how the process became about, but I think the emotion comes through because it is a memory of other ideas and of other maybe experiences Sarah has had, whether it be through her career at City Ballet or personal. That's what's coming through these gestures, and they hold weight to them, to her, and probably to Pam, and to them and their relationship together. And so it's very neat to see that done in this way.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the solo and square dance. I think because there's some moments from it. Yeah, I think she maybe does a square dance thing.
Yeah.
I always think that that's like a memory. That looks like someone chasing like a memory too a little bit. But yeah.
How did it feel to dance to Ted Hearn's music? What do you feel that that added to the ballet, or how that informed the ballet?
Well, I do think that we tried different moments choreographically with different moments of the music. And to what Miriam was saying about how sometimes you need to speed up to reach a certain point, while it both like allows you to detach from the music, it also allows for you to connect with it in really special and surprising ways at different moments. Like, you know, for me, the solo had been made in silence in my bedroom or whatever, and then we did it to different music for the film. And then when we got to Ted Hearn's score, I was more familiar with the steps than I was with the music. So sometimes every time we did it, it would line up in a different way. And I'd be like, oh, that's fun. Like, I hope I hit that point again. Or like, if I didn't, then I'd be like, oh, this actually worked. Then I can do this movement with this sound. And his score is like so energizing and alive, even though we weren't counting it and like appreciating it in the way that we typically do music with other rep. It like really like animated the whole dance in this way that felt particularly obvious to me in the moments when the choreography had once been detached from that music.
What did it feel like to dance in Reed and Harriet's incredibly cool costumes?
I love a Reed and Harriet costume. I mean, they're always colorful, and I think they always highlight, they'll take a look at who the dancer is, and I think that they really know how to design for everybody's individual body, and they are always extremely flattering, and I love my costume. And I think, too, it shows the clarity of Pam's choreography. Yes, there's all of these colors and cuts, but it's not distracting, and it doesn't take away from her choreography or change how the movement looks. If anything, it just highlights it in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, my costume, I mean, you know how this is, Silas, but like sometimes you feel so big on that stage because like when you're over six foot three, as both of us are, it's like sometimes you see a video and you're like, I look enormous. It is wild how big I look. And like wearing a unitard that's virtually all one color with a stripe going down the side really exaggerates and amplifies
the length
and that bigness. And I didn't always like feeling big like that on stage. And I, like this costume made me feel big in this way that I like really loved. Like it felt, this costume, some of Reed and Harriet's costumes I feel like have allowed me to feel like really cozy and comfortable, or like the bright costumes, I think there was a bit more like movement. And this was like, this is my body.
Yeah.
And like, it's like big and I'm bright blue and yellow.
Yeah.
And it's really, this costume made me feel very like empowered and a little bit weird and goofy and also like sexy and big. And it was really, it was like, it's a fun costume to dance in.
I think that goes to the individuality that Pam finds within her dancers and the fact that it's not the most cohesive, all of the costumes together. I mean, and that's not a negative thing, but it's just, I think it shows, it highlights how each dancer is their own person. And Pam highlights that with her choreography. And I think with Reed and Harriet's costumes, it lets everyone be their own person. And it flatters them all and accentuates their individuality and accentuates who they are. And I would hope that everyone wearing it would feel the way that Russell Jansen felt wearing that unitard. Because I think It's important. I mean, what we wear on stage in front of all of these eyes watching us, you want to feel confident. You want to feel comfortable and empowered. And Reed and Harriet are very good at making you feel that way.
Yeah. Three cheers for Reed and Harriet.
Yes.
My last question for the two of you, and you've touched on aspects of this as we've talked together, is are there ways that your work with Pam has now informed the way you approach the works of other choreographers?
I think a little bit maybe it like helped me let go in other works. It was like maybe there is a place for thinking and there's a place for just kind of like giving yourself over to the dance a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I think when I started doing bigger roles and didn't always feel like I was doing them as well as I saw other people doing them, I was like, but I'm thinking so hard. And and like I felt like I was like I really wanted that to be worth something. Both for me and for the audience. And I think that maybe working with Pam, even that just that first time, I think it let me let go a little bit and be like, there's actually different ways to dance in different contexts. And I think that's the beauty of having a rep like ours, is that there is a lot of times where you get to just go out on stage and skip around with your friends. And then there are times when you go out and you have to really think about how you're bending your knee so that you keep your balance, or how you're going into a jump. And then there are times when you get to like think like Pam is asking you to think. Maybe working with Pam kind of like allowed me to let go of what I thought I needed ballet to be in other moments, in part because it gave me an outlet for something that I think I'd really been looking for in a lot of different moments where I maybe wasn't ever going to find it.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that was really beautiful. And I mean, I think I have a similar experience, just in that she made me realize that I don't need to just do ballet to feel fulfilled. Like I can move and I can perform and dance in a different way than what I know and what I've trained for and what I'm here doing. And I can still feel incredibly fulfilled by a different way of movement. And I might not have spent 10 plus years training in that movement, but I'm willing to learn and I want to continue to explore that type of movement, whether it be Cunningham or Pam or a new choreographer that comes, because what you learn in your own artistry and in your own artistic freedom on the stage is it evolves so much through these different choreographers that you are working with. And Pam was the first person that I worked with that opened my eyes to that and that made me feel comfortable, kind of to what I've touched on already, but just made me feel comfortable with acknowledging who I am as a dancer, but also as a human being, and how I want to express myself through movement. Like, why else are we here if we can't express who we are as people through our movement? Like, I don't need to fulfill roles at City Ballet in ways that other people have done them. I can do them in the way that I want to do them, and and the way that makes sense to me, whether I'm thinking a lot or, you know, it sense to my body. It might look different than it looked when someone else did it 20 years ago, or even the next cast does it. Yeah. It's going to look different. And I think Pam really opened my eyes to that, because who's in the studio with you will change how you dance. And it's an ongoing evolution within my own approach to my dancing and exploration to my dancing. And she really jump-started that. Yeah, I don't know how to close, but no, that was that.
But it's amazing.
Yeah, love letter to Pam.
Well, it's amazing to hear how she has impacted both of you, and the time that you've taken to share is such a gift. So thank you all so much for being part of this episode, and it's been a joy speaking with you.
Thanks, Silas. Thank you. That was really fun.
To learn more about Pam Tanowitz and the artists and artworks that have inspired her, please consult the reading list that can be found in the notes for this podcast episode. And listen to the two previous City Ballet podcast episodes about Pam, Season 4, Episode 8, about Bartok Ballet, and Season 11, Episode 5, about the creation of the Law of Mosaics.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you'll join me again to hear the dance.